The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 402 for Wednesday, June 13th, 2012. 7 years of podcasting for your two favorite geeks. Here we go. And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. Can you tell, John, that I have not had a lot of sleep, and you could hear my voice do the Peter Brady patented crack right there at the beginning?
This You're is doing the Mac karaoke, Observer's. Right?
I did. Well, yeah, I just sang one song last night at the Loops party. But the Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips. We provide some answers. We provide some tips of our own. Together, we all try to learn something new, and we've been doing it for 7 years successfully together, and hopefully we can do it for another seven or more. Here in San Francisco, California, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, still in Fairfield, Connecticut, John Efron.
So, yeah, obviously I'm out here at WWDC this week. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but then we've got a pile of your questions and tips and cool stuff found queued up that that hopefully we will make a respectable dent in as we go forward here. But you want to, you know what? Let's go right to the questions, John, and then we'll pick up some of the WWDC stuff afterwards. How's that sound?
Splendid.
All right. And since that's not at all what I was planning to do, I don't have all this right on my screen, but I can make it happen very quickly. Bob writes, I have two items, one for me and one for my neighbor. My neighbor is just starting with Apple equipment as he purchased an iPad 2. He bought the device from Best Buy and the salesperson there sold him AirPlay, reportedly saying, this will work with your HP printer. I think he means AirPrint. In short, it didn't. As a longtime Apple/Mac user, I'd like to help him out. Could you please provide an overview of the various print options for iPad users? Which are the most versatile, and is there a best option out there? All right, so let's tackle that, and then we'll go after his second question, which is about iPhoto. So iPad printing, and really this is iOS printing, so it could be your iPad, your iPhone, your iPod Touch. They all share the same printing framework. And it's weird. There's a knowledge base article that, of course, we'll put in the show notes that lists officially supported AirPrint printers. Now, these are printers that will advertise themselves in such a way that when on the same network, your iPhone or iPad, your iOS device will see them and print directly to them. And it's not a terribly short list, but it's also not a terribly long list. And it only supports printers that are networkable, and not even all of those. So it's very frustrating because printing is not there is no other way of getting things to print officially. There are a couple of third party solutions though. We talked about one, the Lantronix X Print Server, which I think you saw back at Macworld and I played with in the office, John, and that will make any networked printer work. You just hang this device off your network, it'll go find all your network printers and it will share them with your iOS devices. So that's certainly worth checking out if you have a network printer. If you have a printer connected to your Mac, you want to check out Ecamm Network's Printopia, which will do the same thing, but your Mac needs to be on because the printer's connected to it, but it will share that printer in a way that iOS devices will be happy to print to it. I'm not sure why Apple doesn't do more on this front, but perhaps they think they don't need to. I don't know. Any thoughts on this, John?
Oh, we're certainly getting enough people that want it.
So, right. Yeah.
I don't see why you wouldn't want to, because, I mean, to me, I mean, network printing is a pretty standard operation. I mean, I'm printing to my, you know, 20-year-old laser printer here over the network, so I can't see why they can't enable this functionality in iOS. I think the what you mentioned, the XPrint server, I want to tell our crowd here, while I'm trying to deal with listening to myself, echo. Was it $99 or $129 or?
Yeah, I think it's.
I'm bringing up the page right now. It's taking a while because my computer is doing more than one thing right now.
Yeah, John is sending out to the stream, which we're doing again at macgeekgab.com/stream. So you can always join us there. We're going to try and do that every time. It's just an audio stream, and we've got a little chat room up there. And the chat room will continue to get better, and the audio streamer thing will continue to evolve as well. But with me being on the road, John is thankfully offloading some of that responsibility at his own.
I think it's 150.
Okay.
I see a few devices come up here. All right. But you can check their store.lantronics.com, and you can see the various devices they offer. But no, I think XPrint servers, $149.95 or $150, which in lieu of leaving a computer on all the time to offer that up, I think that's a good deal.
Yeah. And I would say watch this space. There are other products, other companies interested in helping you solve this problem. So watch this space. There is stuff coming, which is good. All right. Question number two is, my issue, Bob says, is with iPhoto. I'm trying to create a reference library by exporting my almost 20,000 photos, including some video. I start the export and it stops periodically with a message saying unable to create file name. I then have to search through my iPhoto photos and restart the export with a few photos later after the last photo exported. I've run into this with various options of export, current, JPEG, TIFF, etc. Any ideas as to how I can create an export with all the photos? Once I've exported my photos, it looks like I should create a new clean iPhoto library by importing the photos that were just exported. So this actually may have changed on Monday. I haven't messed around too much, but we're getting these sort of synchronized library possibilities between iPhoto and Aperture now. But even still, I would turn to Fat Cat Software's iPhoto Library Manager. That's going to be a way better solution than trying to do this yourself. It is purpose-built to move photos from one library to another, or copy photos from one library to another, and then, of course, you can remove them. And it manages the whole process for you. So definitely go ahead and check that out. That may be the easy answer to your problem. It's great software for all of you out there. I've been using it for years. And I don't do a ton with iPhoto, but I do wind up having to move photos around between libraries, and it's awesome. I couldn't live without it. So,
and my thought on this is, it sounds like there may be some damage to the iPhoto library. Now, if only there was a way for you to try and repair that damage, and the good news is that there is. We'll link to the article, but in a nutshell, what you do is when you launch iPhoto, you hold down Option and Command, and you will then get a dialog that says rebuild photo library, and it gives you probably about six options. I don't think I clicked them all at once, but I'd probably go through them, and they'll do various things: repair the database, fix permissions, rebuild the thumbnails. My guess is that there's something that's munged a bit, so what happens is that it kind of gives up, or that there's something wrong with the volume you're writing to, though I think it's more likely that the photo library itself has a little hiccup in it, and this should be able to fix it.
Yeah, I bet that's right. Yeah, good thinking. I forgot about that. All right, awesome. Moving on to Andrew, and we'll let Andrew tell us. I think we'll let Andrew tell us. Is my computer going to behave here?
Hey, John and Dave, and possibly Pilot Pete. It's Andrew from Colchester, Connecticut, and I'll give you my brief story here. Hopefully I'll keep it short for you. I have a big 27-inch iMac that I do most of my heavy lifting with, which is not the computer in question, but it's kind of important to the story. I also have a 2006 white MacBook, 2 gigahertz Core 2 Duo, upgraded to 4 gigabytes of RAM, computer notices 3. You guys know how that works. And I've been kind of on a quest to make this machine the most it can be since I have my new iMac 2011 at home. The next step, I just ordered a 128 gigabyte SSD from OWC, and obviously I'm going to want to transfer the data on the spinning drive in the MacBook to that solid state drive. I know obviously it'll involve carbon copy cloner, moving some data over, but I think I remember you guys mentioning before that there was some kind of issue with the recovery partition. like you needed to move that as well, or create the partition and move it over, something like that. It wasn't as simple as just cloning Macintosh HD over to the SSD and getting going. You know what I'm saying? So.
Uh-oh. Well, we've lost his audio. Hopefully that doesn't mean we've lost everyone's audio for this show. Yeah, that's good. Hi, John. But I think we got enough of his question. So the concept is migrating to SSD. And yes, with Lion, it's very important to have that recovery partition. And no, when you just do a normal copy over, it does not copy that recovery partition. And that's actually going to be a problem for two things. Number one, the obvious, if you want to use the recovery partition to either repair, or reinstall, or do some maintenance. But the other is that I think back to my Find My Mac, not back to my Mac, Find My Mac requires a recovery partition exist before you can turn it on.
Yes.
Which is strange. I'm not exactly sure of the reasoning behind that, but it is what it is. And so you want that recovery partition. But the good news is Carbon Copy Cloner is the software that will, I think it's the only software at the moment that will easily clone your recovery partition to a new drive as well. So just make sure you do that. And I think we have it's not a knowledge base article, maybe an FAQ entry about just how that works. And we'll make sure to put that in the show notes for you too. Do you have anything, John, here?
Yes, I do. Well, there's another thing here. So I guess the question is, do you need it? And would say for a couple of things you do, as you pointed out, Dave, for Find My Mac, you do. Because I remember when I was reviewing another hard drive, I didn't copy it over. And I noticed this in the iCloud preference pane. It said, well, you can't do this because this isn't here. In the back of my mind, I seem to recall that if you want to enable File Vault, I think that may require the recovery partition as well. I'm not 100% sure about that. Maybe not.
Now, that would actually make sense. Yeah.
I don't know if it's to put the keys there or something. It seems in the back of my mind, I recall that you may need that. But do you absolutely need it? I don't know if you absolutely do. Now, there is a tool that you can use to I guess, create a standalone one. I don't know if you've used this, Dave, but there's something called Lion Recovery Disk Assistant 1.0.
Okay. But that only works if you already have one, right?
Right. I guess what I'm pointing out is just this is a tool that lets you create a standalone recovery device, I guess.
Yeah, I think
just
that's right.
Just a little piece of information. It's not gonna create it on a drive that doesn't have it. Yeah, in that case, as you pointed out, you need something like our pal Carbon Copy Cloner. So,
well, and actually, Carbon Copy Cloner is not going to do it either if you don't already have one. You need to have a drive that has one, and then either Apple's utility can create a standalone one, or Carbon Copy Cloner can beam it over to another drive. But the only way to create one is from Apple's installer. So, all right. I want to talk about our first sponsor, John, which is Barebones Software at barebones.com with BB Edit. BB Edit is a mainstay in Mac text editors. They've been developing BB Edit for over 20 years now. And BB Edit is really so full-featured, it's ridiculous. There's no way we could talk about all of its features. Editing text is obviously at its core. As you're editing text, if you've listened to this show for a while, you know that it will automatically sense what language you're in. And it could be languages like Objective-C or JavaScript or HTML or PHP, lots of different things. And it will automatically color on the screen. The text file remains just text, but on the screen, it colors and highlights and formats the code based on what language you're in. So it can make things really, really easy to go through. It's also really cool because it has an FTP client built in. So if you're editing, say, a web page that you have and it's up on a server somewhere, you can pull down the file, but you pull it right into BB Edit. There's not a two-step process. You don't have to download the file first and then open it in BB Edit. BB Edit opens it across from the FTP server directly. And when you hit save, it saves it back to the FTP server. So it's just doing this on the fly automatically. Once you've got it open and you're hitting save, you don't even have to think about it. It just blasts it off and saves it to the server. So you can make a little change, hit save, and go reload in your web browser, and boom, you can see it right there. BBEdit is available. You can, well, I would recommend you go check out the download right from the trial version right from Barebones website at barebones.com. When you're ready to buy, it's $49.99 there. It's also $49.99 in the App Store. So in the Mac App Store, that is. So go ahead and check it out. And one thing, if you do download it from the App Store, you can go to Barebones website and install their free command line tools. And what those let you do is if you're at the terminal and you type BBEdit space and then a file name, it'll actually open that file in the full graphical version of BBEdit. That's something they can't distribute via the App Store because it puts commands out on your system. But it will work with the version that you got in the App Store. So go ahead and check it out, barebones.com. All right, John, moving on to Carl. I think you're going to read Carl's question for us.
You think so, huh?
Well, that was my hope.
Hi, guys. It's Carl here from Belfast in Northern Ireland. First question. When I enter a new event into iCal, the default duration setting is all day. That's okay by me. However, when I then uncheck the all day checkbox, the timings are automatically adjusted to a 10 a.m. start time and an 1800 end time. My particular problem arises when, in a hurry, I only have time to enter the event start time. If an event is scheduled for late evening, it means that the default 8-hour duration extends to the next day, and so on. Let's see. Obvious solution is take the time to correct it. And I don't think I need to read the rest here. So I'm going to help solve his problem here. And this problem is actually specific to the view that he's in. And I'm going to tell you what view that he's in. Is that he's in the month view. Because this is when this happens. So if you're in the month view and you double click on the calendar to try to create an event, the default duration will be all day. If you're in the week or the day view, it'll be an hour. So that's one way to get around this. Here's the other way to get around it, though, that I didn't know until I did the Google Foo. If you're in the month view, so you double click, and then you start entering the name at event, and then you also enter the start time. So say I want to have breakfast with you at 8 a.m. Well, type in breakfast, 8 a.m., and it'll start at that time and have a duration of an hour. That's almost too clever for me. And then I never knew I could do that before. Of course, it takes the time out once it goes on the calendar. But it's smart enough to realize that, well, that's the start time you want for the event.
That's pretty
cool. The other thing is that you can change the default of event time from 1 hour to something else. 1 hour is the default for anything that is on the order of hours. And you can either hop on the terminal. Now, I have an article that I found that goes over some of this stuff as well. But you can either go to the terminal and it's default space write space com.apple.ical space. And then the whole default duration in minutes for a new event. And then you can enter another thing. Or a lot easier is to use my pal, the pref pane called secrets, which also lets you enter this value in the secrets pref pane. So you can change it from an hour to however many minutes you want.
That's awesome. Hey, you mentioned that the calendar has some of these contextual smarts while your iCal does as you're putting stuff in. One thing that's worth checking out is a relatively new piece of software. It came out in the last year, called Fantastical from FlexiBits. And this is a little menu bar applet. And it not only shows you your calendar, but also lets you do this contextual event creation. And you can start just typing things. And, you know, the demo they show on their website is, you know, lunch with John at 123 Main Street on Thursday. And boom, it fills it all out as it should be. The location in the right spot, you know, the time of it. They pick up that you said lunch, so they put noon. And it's actually really, really cool. It takes what you've seen there in iCal, John, and makes it like magic. So So definitely worth checking out. It's only $10 to buy it, but you can go and try it out from their website at FlexiBits. So definitely worth checking out. These guys are they're onto something here. It's good stuff. So go ahead.
Well, he had two questions. Or are we not going to bother with the second one?
I wasn't even this was all you. So I don't know. We can do the second one.
All right. Well, it's a surprise.
Do you
want to
do the second?
Well, sure. Well, I
go ahead. Yeah, surprise question. Go ahead.
Well, no. Here's what he says. So when he opens and closes a PDF file in Preview, and then he drags it to the trash, and he attempts to empty the trash will, or the Finder will say the operation can't be completed because the item is in use. In order to successfully empty the trash, he has to close Preview. So what's going on here?
So on the surface, and I don't necessarily have the answer, but on the surface, your Mac is smart enough to not let you empty the trash, i.e. completely remove a file, if some app still has it open. And so that's what's happening here is for whatever reason, the OS thinks that Preview still has this file open. Now, I tried this and it did not do this for me. So I wasn't able to easily figure this out. But I think you could look at, gosh, I don't know if IOSTAT from the terminal would do this. No, I don't think it would. I think that's just going to give you bandwidth. I'm trying to think, John, and maybe one of our listeners can help us. That there is a terminal command in Unix that'll tell you what apps have what files open. I mean, I guess the OS is telling us that it's Preview that has it open, but it just seems strange that it would do this. I don't, you know, it's one of those things where I would start by cleaning my caches or at the very least just boot up in safe mode once to kind of make it do all of that stuff. I don't know that that's going to solve it, but it seems like one of these wacky little problems. Did you have any thoughts on this one, or are we swimming in dark water? I don't know what that means, but it seemed like the right thing to say.
That sounds great. I mean, you can look in Activity Monitor, and that'll show you what files a process has open. But yeah, you don't want to click on each process to slide.
Oh, but it's telling us, it's telling him that it's Preview.
Oh, that's Preview.
Right. Hmm. Yeah. And it stands to reason because it was just open in Preview. But it just seems weird that, I wonder if it's in like a separate window or a separate desktop, but I mean, it sounds like Carl understands what he's doing here, and I believe him when he says he's closed the window out. So that's kind of the weird part. I don't have a magic answer. If somebody out there does, though, that would be it would be helpful to all of us, and of course, especially to listener Carl. All right, moving on. Unless you have anything else on this one, we'll move on to Marco here. Okay. And while I'm reading Marco, I will ask you to check your bandwidth over there. You started to sound a little Skypey. I don't know if that's me being on the 4G wireless or if it was you. So I'll mention that. It's not terrible. So it's certainly livable for the show.
Yeah, it shows I'm at 16, I think. I'll talk more, maybe.
Okay. All right, so Marco writes, AirDrop is a cool way to send files in your network, but you have to have, but if you have one Mac that is not on the very short list of supported Macs in AirDrop, you are out of luck. I have one Mac Mini that is not on the list, but I would like it to work with my MacBook Pro 13-inch that is supported by AirDrop. I found many articles on the internet that show how to enable AirDrop in unsupported Macs. This is great, but is it safe to use? And he's talking about using a command line thing where you just do a defaults write on the command line. We can link to an article about it. But it essentially tells AirDrop to look at everything, and then it works. He says, what do you think about this? Is this safe to do? And the answer, my answer is, yeah, I think it is safe to do. I've used it with unsupported Macs with no problem. I don't use it a ton, but I have used it, and it works just fine, and it is handy, as a way to get files back and forth. So I have it turned on all my Macs and haven't had any real problems. I don't know if you've used it, John. I think you've got one supported Mac and one unsupported Mac for AirDrop. AirDrop shows up in the sidebar of only Lion, right, John? Not Snow Leopard.
I only have one unsupported machine where for Kicks I enabled it, but I don't have any other machine at this point for it to talk to.
Right, because your other machine's on Snow Leopard.
That may have to change.
Yes, I think it's going to have to change. Yeah. AirDrop shows up in the sidebar. It's pretty cool. If you haven't ever clicked on it, just go over there and you'll see other machines show up in there and you can just blast things out, which is pretty, pretty cool. So no further thoughts on that, John?
No, I haven't used it, so.
All right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, how could you have used it? That's right. Okay, so let's move on to Chris. Chris has a follow-up question to our mail discussion in a recent show. And Chris writes, in MacGeekEp 398, you discussed in detail the setup of Mail.app to work better with Gmail. Given Gmail's IMAP implementation, it seems you have to jump through quite a few hoops to make them all play well together. At least the solution seems inelegant. For this reason, I prefer to use only Gmail via the web interface on any computer or via the Gmail app on my iPhone. I completely understand using Mail.app for POP and IMAP email that isn't Gmail. However, I'm curious as to why both of you, as Gmail users, use Mail.app for your Gmail accounts. Is it simply to have all of your email from every account in one place? Is offline access critical? I'm just interested to hear your thoughts. All right. Chris, so for me, and perhaps John, you're in the same boat, maybe not. We'll pass it back and forth. But for me, it's both local storage and management. I'm used to Mail's interface. I prefer Mail's interface. And so that's how I like to access my email. But I'm also more comfortable and certainly very accustomed to having a local copy of all of my mail. So maybe that's a concept that's now been kind of deprecated with everything being in the cloud all the time. But I do like having it local. So that's why I use mail. And it is occasionally, certainly on my laptop, it is nice to have offline access, sometimes on an airplane or if I'm just somewhere where I don't have, access to a web browser and I can't pull up, Gmail's interface. So that's why I do it. John, you?
I'm with you. And to me, the reason that you want the local copy, now you may be asking yourself, how do I do this? And I'm going to tell you, at least with Mail app, is that if you're in the accounts pane and then you click on advanced, you're going to have
in preferences,
checkbox.
Right?
Correct. Preferences, accounts. And let's see. Where is it? Advanced. And there's going to be a little pull down. Keep copies of messages for offline viewing. And I have it set to all messages and their attachments. Because I think, as you pointed out, Dave, the cloud is both the solution, but it's also the problem. And that, what if the cloud's not there? Then you're screwed.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's concerned me about any of these services that isolate or require you access the cloud. And I've heard people shake their fist about many of them. Like, there are certain games now, I think, where they reach out to an activation server, even though you're playing a single player version of it, or some other stupid things here. So having a copy in both places to me is just a failsafe, if nothing else.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's see. Let's talk about Joel here, John. Because Joel has something very timely to discuss with us. Joel says, I'm still running Snow Leopard on my Mac, but plan to upgrade to Mountain Lion when it comes out. Do you have any guidance on whether I can upgrade from Snow Leopard right to Mountain Lion, or if I'll need to go to Lion first? If I need to upgrade to Lion before, can I jump to Mountain Lion? I'll probably do that now, but I'd prefer to skip that entirely if I can. So good news on Monday at Apple's keynote, they announced not only the pricing of Mountain Lion, which is only $19.99 US, but that pricing and presumably the up updater and the installer will update from either Snow Leopard or Lion. So you're in luck. You can jump straight from Snow Leopard to Lion. I will say, and I have not tried this, so this is simply based on the experience that we've kind of all had with Lion. I would wait until after Mountain Lion comes out, but I would assume, until we learn otherwise, that the Snow Leopard to Mountain Lion migration, upgrade rather, is going to be kind of fraught with similar difficulties that we see when going from Snow Leopard to Lion. So my advice would be a clean install, a clean install, but that means clone your drive first because you're going to wipe out your drive. Make a clone of your drive, do a clean install, and then use Migration Assistant to bring your data and apps back. That seems to have worked very well with Lion, and so would be the safest route to take with Mountain Lion. Obviously, once it comes out and we hear a lot more from a lot of users, maybe we'll find that they've fixed whatever wackiness, lack of a better term, was out there with the upgrade from Snow Leopard to Lion. So that's my advice on this. John, anything from you?
No. Now, do you think they're going to allow the same wackiness of burning the disk image file?
I would imagine. I mean, it's going to be a Mac App Store only kind of thing. So, I think we live with that now. Well, you know, it's kind of how it goes. They're not going to distribute it on DVD anymore because they just announced a bunch of new computers that don't have DVD drives. So, you know what I mean?
Mr. I do. Braun? We can talk about that. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a fish shape coming up.
Okay.
Well, they're offering before some machines without a lot of things.
Before we do the fish shake, I want to talk about our second sponsor, which is a new sponsor for us, and it's Apollon. And they make an app. They actually make it for Mac as well as iOS, called Pimp Your Screen. And what this is, it's 99 cents in the iOS App Store. It's designed to work with both your iPhone and your iPad. And the idea behind the app is that it allows you to customize the look of your iOS devices by offering backgrounds that make it look like you have app shelves and or icon skins that kind of go around where the icons are. You can, if you're into it, you can have your stuff look neon or a little more subdued, customized home screens. So what they've done here is they've gone and they've got this team of professional designers, and they've created all these awesome backgrounds that when your apps are laid on top of them, it really kind of comes into its own. You've got to see this to really appreciate it. But it's pretty cool. So go check out some of the screenshots in the App Store. And it's 99 cents, so it's totally worth downloading and playing with. And then, you know, they also have a Mac version that kind of is built to do the same thing with your desktop, and that's in the Mac App Store for $2.99. But go get the iOS version now, because that's only 99 cents, and I think that's half price from what it normally is. So they're doing that just in concert with the ads that they're running with us here. So again, it's from Apollon, and it's called Pimp Your Screen for iPhone, or really for iOS, but it's just Pimp Your Screen in the iTunes App Store. We'll put a link, of course, in the show notes as a sponsor link, because that's how we do that sort of thing. And it's only 99 cents, so spend a buck and have some fun. Apollon's Pimp Your Screen. So we started talking about WWDC, John. So let's let that roll. You clearly have some thoughts on this, so go.
Well, the what I don't like, so the good news is they introduced new MacBooks. That didn't surprise a lot of people.
Right.
And actually, I'll give them a thumbs up on the one aspect here. So the new, well, they have two now, or I guess they have four, two. Well, but they have now what I'll call a continuation of the classic MacBook Pro line. And that looks pretty cool. Because not only do they have Thunderbolt and Gig Ethernet and stuff like that, but they now have, thank goodness, USB 3. I think they pretty much admitted, you know what? Thunderbolt's really not catching on. I mean, I think you and I recognize, I mean, I can count the number of Thunderbolt peripherals on one or maybe two hands and maybe 1 or 2 feet. It's so limited. It's growing, but it's still such a small segment of the market. Whereas USB 3, I mean, I've already tried a USB 3 device, and they're not quite as fast, but I think they're also not quite as expensive given the same capacity. And it's already taken hold in the PC world. So that, to me, is...
Right.
So I'd like that aspect, that the latest one. And I think now that may nudge me. Because, yeah, I was like, well, you know, they have a high-speed port on the new MacBook, but it's Thunderbolt, and it's limited. But the Retina display machine, this is the one that makes me shake my fist. And you probably know why.
Because of the
price? Soldered in RAM. And you can only choose, as far as I could tell, from one of two flash drive configurations or SSD configurations. So the good news is that it's very thin and very sexy.
Yes.
And I think they had a video showing them, you know, trying to break it. You know, that was very tough. So I think performance-wise, it's a nice machine. And, of course, the display is going to be beautiful once everybody catches up to that. I guess they got to... you know, get the display drivers to work, or people have to tune their software to work with the Retina display. But to
it's like it was on iOS. I'm sure it's going to be the same, that the pixel density is doubled. So you've got 2 pixels per point as opposed to one, or, I mean, that's 'cause that's how it was on iOS. So yeah. Yeah. So and app developers will have to enhance things. That's right. Yeah.
But I don't like the direction, though they're taking it with other pieces of hardware, but the direction that the RAM you get and the SSD you get is what you get, I don't like that. And I think it also doesn't have a gigabit Ethernet port. I guess you can get that through Thunderbolt, which, well, that's nice. So I think
they've actually
upgrade to either one of those, I would steer away from that machine, because I don't like what you get is what you get. And the regular MacBook Pro, again, has relatively more ports. Oh, and FireWire also. I know some people, you know, they're saying, John, get with it. You know, FireWire is an old, relatively old technology, but I still have FireWire 800 devices or 400 with an adapter. So if I had to choose between the two, I think I'd go for the 15-inch MacBook Pro non-Retina display. And I noticed that they kind of shunned the 17-inch. I don't know if that form factor is going to be long for this world.
They certainly don't have a 17 inch now, but it is important to note that the resolution of the 15 inch MacBook Pro, I think, is greater than the resolution on a 27 inch iMac, right? But slightly, maybe, you know, 10% or something like that.
I think you get a high res option. I think they have a regular resolution and then a high res screen. I think there are 3 choices, right?
On the MacBook Pro?
Yes.
Well, the Retina display MacBook Pro is one.
Oh, no, I meant the other one.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, can you get different screen resolutions?
Yes.
I think you're getting 1280 by 800 on the 13-inch or 1440 by 900 on the 15-inch. I don't think... Oh, that's right. No, you can. On the 15-inch, you can go up to the high res. They don't call it Retina because it's not, but that's right. You can go up to the 1680 by 1050. That's right. That's right. Good catch. But, you know, you mentioned FireWire and Gigabit Ethernet, and as you said, there's a Thunderbolt to Gigabit adapter. There's also a Thunderbolt to FireWire adapter. You can get Thunderbolt to FireWire 800 now that they announced on Monday.
Yeah, so that's good. So
$29.
So the benefit of the Retina display one is that, you know, it's thinner and lighter, but you may have to lug around some adapters if you use some.
Yeah, but you'll have all that extra room because of all the
sure.
money that you've liberated from your wallet.
Right. No, I understand why they did what they did, but
sure.
again, the fact that there are things in that machine that used to be user fiddleable and are not kind of bothers me.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing the concept of the MacBook Air, trickle down or trickle up right, trickle across to the MacBook Pro. You know, yeah. But so yeah, you can. I think you can get it with either, depending on what model you buy, you can get it with two. There's two flash storage. The high end model is either 512 or 768 for a $500 premium. But that's a lot of flash storage. And I think the smaller one, it's either, or the slower one is either 256 or 512, right? Is that right, John? Or is it only 256 on the slower one? Yes, it's only 256 on the slower one. Yeah, I'm looking at the store right now. So the $2199 one, you get 256 gigs of flash storage, and that's it. You can go 8 or 16 gigs of RAM. And it at $200, and like you said, soldered in RAM. And is that true? There's no, the RAM is not expandable? I didn't realize that. I've been sort of, you know, heads down a little bit.
Nope, not the Retina. No, I've seen a few, several places, we'll link to a few of them, but I think I saw an iFixit article and a think Gizmodo, okay, and a few other people. But they dubbed this the least serviceable Mac ever.
Wow.
And then I think they even have the pentalobe screws. So number one, even to open the darn thing, you got to get a special screwdriver.
Oh, that's crazy. They why do they do that to us, John?
They don't. They know what's best for you, Dave. They don't want you touching anything.
Yeah, well, that's how it goes. All right. I know I had some other things from... where the heck is my... I had a whole big list of things from...
Well, I'll toss a few out. WWDC. So the updated Aperture.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, keep going. Yeah,
I think the big deal with Aperture, so, you know, they changed the interface, they renamed some things. I think the big deal is now they have what I guess they'll call a unified or shared photo library. So you can now share a photo library between Aperture and iPhoto. That's kind of neat.
I think that's pretty cool.
I mean, before you could kind of do it in that you could, from Aperture, reference your iPhoto, but I was never comfortable doing that. But
right,
now it's official.
But now it's and it's all the same, right? Any changes you make in one are then reflected when you open the other app, right? I mean, it is one unified library that they both see, right?
As far as I know, I haven't tried it quite yet.
Okay.
I had to wait.
I'm pretty sure of that.
Now, this is kind of weird. So, like, oh, Aperture 3.3, that's great. You know, upgraded to it, ran it on my MacBook Pro where I keep all my photos and have Aperture 3.3. And it did a background update of like 10,000 previews. It was taking a real... Oh. It took a little while.
Wow.
It was doing something else. In addition to saying, okay, by the way, I'm changing your library, and once I do this, prior versions of Aperture won't be able to understand it. They're like, okay. But then I went to my Mac Mini, which is running Snow Leopard and is also running the App Store, and I said, oh, well, upgrade to Aperture 3.3, and it's like, nope, nope, nope. 10.7.4 required.
Oh, interesting.
So apparently, the last version before 3.3 is the last version of Aperture you can run on Snow Leopard. And I think,
well,
someone confirmed
it was Aperture,
this in a form. Or at least you can't update
it. Was Aperture up? Was it no? Was it updated for the Retina display? Was that one of the apps that was updated for the Retina display MacBook Pros? Because if it was, those ship with 10.7.4, and it would stand to reason that there's some smarts in 10.7.4 that are required to make that magic happen. So that may be the sole reason why. But you know, they also want to get you off of Snow Leopard. And I was thinking I was going to have to upgrade the podcast machine in the studio off of Snow Leopard 2 because I'm going to be leaving Mobile Me behind at the end of this month. And Barebones promises that we will see an iCloud sync capable version of Yojimbo before the Mobile Me sunset. And, you know, I think you and I can count down to that. It's like, you know, a half a month and a day left. But it hit me that I'm going to have to move that machine to Lion in order to get iCloud syncing on it. And of course I rely on that for what we do here. So I guess I got to do that, but that's okay. That's all in the name of progress, John. We must move forward. That's what our benevolent overlords at Apple tell us anyway.
One step forward, two steps
back. Right? No, no, no. That was Paula Abdul that said that. Our benevolent overlords at Apple never said the two steps back. Right? Did you expect me to quote Paula Abdul or reference Paula Abdul? Good. Speaking of iCloud, we have a question, so we'll jump to the question. If we want to jump back to some of the WWDC stuff, we can. Steven posted, actually, on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/MacGeekGab. He says, here's a question with some urgency. I've been procrastinating on dealing with the end of Mobile Me. Welcome to the club, Steven. You're in good company. Well, now force the conversation to the conversion to iCloud is coming. And before my data crashes and burns, I'm hoping you guys can answer this. I haven't found the info clearly explained anywhere. My hardware is an iPhone 4 with iOS 5.1, a 13-inch MacBook Pro with Snow Leopard. I'm not interested in upgrading to Lion. I don't like a lot of the changes. I can't risk issues with Final Cut Pro 7 running on it. I'm sure I will someday, but only when circumstances force it. If I switch to iCloud and do not upgrade to Lion, I don't understand exactly what I will lose and how I can work around it. The truth may be out there, but it's not all in one concise place. It seems like I lose everything except my email address. None of the sync services appear like they work without Lion, bookmarks, contacts, calendar, photos. Is that correct? Is switching to Google for contacts and calendar the easiest thing to do? I already have a separate Gmail account. Okay, so if you move to iCloud without going to Lion, you do lose all of that sync functionality embedded in your Mac. But you can still get at the data, the bookmarks, the contacts, the calendar, through iCloud.com's web interface. Mail will still work from within Snow Leopard. iCal will not let you sync with your calendar, but BusyCal will. BusyCal, it does not care if you're on Lion or not. There is a way, and we can put a link in the show notes to the BusyCal article that talks about this. So it is third-party software that you have to go and buy, but it will let you use iCloud's calendar with this. But your idea of moving to a Gmail or a Google-based calendar and contact syncing is fine as well. That will continue to work in Snow Leopard. It will continue to work with your iOS device, and it is platform agnostic. So I'm sure you'll run into some quirks because everything syncs a little bit differently. But I actually sync with I sync with all three currently on my iOS devices. I sync with Google, I sync with Mobile Me, and I sync with iCloud. And for contacts and calendars, and it works great. So yeah, if you want to stay with Snow Leopard, I think Google is a great idea for that. Any thoughts on that, John?
Nope.
Nothing. All right. Take us to Joshua, unless you have something else about WWDC you want to rant about.
Let me look at the reports.
So I have one thing. I was sitting in a session today and watching these Apple engineers talk about something, and it was some iOS thing. But it hit me. It was like, gosh, you know, less than 4 years ago, we didn't even have the option of writing our own apps for iOS, right? I mean, this is a really, really new thing. And yet now, I mean, there are frameworks out there. This is like, it's a mature development platform for iOS, and you can do a lot of stuff with it, and it keeps getting better, and it keeps getting more and more extensible, and Apple's really interested in making sure developers have access that they want within Apple's bounds. I mean, they have their kind of concepts and ideas about how far things should be able to go, but within that box, they really want to enhance things, and it's amazing to have a platform that's 4 years old that's this robust. And of course, the reality is this platform is way more than 4 years old. I think it's more than 24 years old, right? It's like 26 years old if you go all the way back to the origins of Objective-C with the Next, right? And then that got me to thinking about a thing I went to on Monday night. Michael Johnson, who is Dr. Wave, I think he's the creative director at Pixar, he held a fundraiser at the Cartoon Art Museum here in San Francisco. And he focused on Next. It was sort of a Next retrospective, and he had a couple of Next people talk. Andrew Stone spoke, and Will Shipley spoke, And these were the guys, you know, that weren't working at Apple, but they were kind of the fringes sort of around the third party people sort of around they weren't working at Apple, but they also weren't working at Next. But they were sort of in the fringes of developing this stuff. And they've really been working on this. You know, Andrew Stone in an interview with us at the Mac Observer, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, said he'd been developing for iOS for 25 years. And it really is true. You know, this stuff, it's pretty amazing that we've got a platform that is that old and is that robust. And Will Shipley actually told a story at the event about how Rhapsody, which is what we call OS X now, was almost killed by Steve Jobs after you know, he came back to Apple, which was interesting because that was sort of the technology that they bought from Next. But he and Will and Steve actually had a little email exchange about it, and that I think in part helped kind of save what we know as OS X today. But it's interesting that this stuff goes, you know, that it really does go that far back, and there's people that really want to make it work. So it's good. It's very interesting. Anyway, just hitting me that we have this platform that's ostensibly less than 4 years old and yet has all this great stuff in it. So I don't know. There you go. Mr. Braun?
Yes.
You still with me?
I'm with you.
And you have anything to, did you have anything to add about WWDC announcements or anything like that?
Not really.
All right. Then take us to Joshua.
All right. We get to share on this one. Joshua asks, I've successfully opened up ports at my school network that I can access my Xserve from home, both using screen sharing and AFP, which is Apple File Protocol, or way to share files or access files on that machine. I like being able to browse server files from home using the Finder, but I've heard that AFP over the internet is not secure. Is there a more secure way that still preserves using the Finder interface? And you know, I think he's right on this. Because I was digging around and trying to figure, right. Well, is AFP secure? Because, you know, when you connect to an Apple Share server, it says, well, I'm connecting and, you know, give me a password. So there's some security there. And actually, I did a little digging around. And as far as I can tell, normally the exchange of the password is secure. So someone can't look at the line and figure out what your username and password is on the server. And how can you tell this? Well, I found this file. It was buried in my library preferences folder, com.apple.appleshareclient.plist. And there's actually a couple of fields in there, and one is AFP clear text allow, and on my machine it's disabled, and another AFP clear text warn. And that's unchecked as well. Maybe that should
be
checked.
I've seen that warning. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you're sending at least a password in clear text, and I think a lot of things do this, not just file sharing, but I think also the browser. If you're in Safari and for some reason you're connecting to a website and they didn't implement security properly, then it'll say, whoa, whoa, I'm sending this in an insecure manner. Are you sure about this? So, but as far as I know, the AFP protocol itself is not secure. So, what do you do?
No, it's not.
And well, neither is a couple of the things. Screen sharing, which is VNC. But now I give him an answer, and I think I'd like you to dig into this, Dave, because I think you've actually done this, and then I have a solution for a third-party piece of software. But I think in his case, now when he's mentioning Xserve, now if he's running an Xserve, then I'm almost positive that's running OS X server, right?
Safe assumption, sure, yeah.
And as far as I know, OS X server has a VPN server.
Correct.
So one thing he could do is, now I don't know if he's administering the machine. If he is, then he should be able to set up the VPN server and then set up on the Mac in System Preferences Network, add a VPN network interface, and then everything else should be secure, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you tunneled through the VPN, which is secured, then yes, you can. Then and anything you do is going to be secure. That's right. Yeah. So yes, that would be one way to do it.
The other way that's a little geekier, and I found an article that started to describe it. Now, I've actually done this, but I think you've done this, Dave. And there's another secure protocol. So the VPN uses things like IPsec and IPTP and some other, you know, acronyms. But SSH, Secure Shell, is another way to securely connect from one computer, Mac or otherwise, I think pretty much Unix-based. Well, no, pretty much every major platform has an SSH implementation. So I think if you make an SSH connection, you can then tunnel the AFP or screen sharing traffic over that. Now, I don't know the specifics, and I think you've done this, Dave, haven't you?
I've tunneled over SSH. Yeah, you have to... You would make it so that you can SSH into the machine in question. So instead of opening up port 548 and pointing that at your machine, you'd open up port 22 in your firewall or your router, and you connect to the machine over 22, which is SSH. And then from there, you can build a tunnel. There's shell scripts available to kind of walk you through that process. But it's, you know, SSH is built to do that, and it does work. I think the VPN is easier, but I say that because I have a VPN set up. So for me, it is at the moment easier, but I don't know that it's from the ground up. I don't know that one is necessarily easier than the other. The nice part about setting up a VPN is it's sort of this more universal thing. With SSH tunnels, you have to sort of create a tunnel for each thing that you want to do. Whereas with a VPN, you connect over the VPN. As long as that connection is appropriately secured, then anything you do and anything you could think of doing in the future, it will just automatically, for the most part, just automatically work. And so it's a little more, well, it's a lot more robust from that standpoint. So that's kind of why I like the VPN. And yeah, if you've got an OS X server of any kind, you can run your own VPN. If you've got those Buffalo routers that we've talked about, any of the routers that run DD-WRT as a firmware, but even some Buffalo routers with their own firmware in them will run allow you to run a simple VPN, and that's really all you need. It's really handy. So, and I think back to my Mac is secure. That I'm pretty certain of.
Yes. When I did try to implement that, yeah, I would see various secure processes come up because I was running my pal Little Snitch, and it would say, oh, I'm running, like, I think one is Raccoon and some other low-level commands that are setting up a secure tunnel. So yeah, last I checked, Mac is also.
Yeah, which makes sense because it's built to be used over a WAN, over the internet. You know, whereas AFP and even VNC are ostensibly, the assumption is that you're going to run these locally. And if you do want to run them over the internet, well, then you're going to build an SSH tunnel or a VPN or something that kind of handles the security separately. So that's...
Yeah, look at this. I just looked it up. Raccoon is a key management daemon. Whoa. Okay, that sounds serious.
Nice. So,
now, the other thing that I could...
Fun stuff.
Mention is a piece of software that I came across that is really simple, and it's called TeamViewer.
Oh yeah,
and I like it because a friend of mine who does support mostly for people that aren't very tech savvy says, you know, I need a zero configuration, something where I can just have them run a program and then I can tunnel into their machine. And these guys offer something that will let you do that. So they actually offer like a quick install version of their, I'll call it the server, which is the machine that you want to connect to, and you run their software, and then what it does is actually registers with their server, and then it generates a unique, or prints on the screen, I think a username and password. And then what happens is you tell someone else that you'd like to connect to you those values, and then that phones home to their server as well. And it virtually connects the two. And that's working through, I think it's working through both port 80 and 443, which of course is SSL and secure. and it'll let you do viewing, and I think it'll let you do file transfer as well. And it was pretty good. You know, well, I think any screen share is kind of sluggish, but I think they're one of the better, and for non-commercial use, it's a freebie, so I think that's worth checking out, teamviewer.com.
Yeah, no, very good point. Yeah, this is good for, you know, not just for this one specific purpose. So this is kind of, you know, everybody heads up here. Check out teamviewer.com. It really works very, very well. We've had a lot of listeners recommend it over the years. And yeah, it's an easy, easy way of remote controlling and securing that remote control in a very simple way. So yeah, good call. Excellent, John. All right. Moving on and finishing up the question portion of the show with Sherwin. Sherwin writes, John and Dave, I am a longtime listener and iOS user. I have a question. I'm planning to buy my first MacBook Pro, especially with the new refresh, but I have only one concern, and that is the lack of a numeric keypad. I input lots of numbers. On my Windows PC, there is the function plus numlock to turn some of the keys on the keyboard into numbers. I'd like to know if there is something like this on the MacBook. John, I turn to you. Can you help, Sherwin?
Yes. And you can do this on the Mac as well. You hold down the function key and you can press certain keys and you get a virtual numeric keypad.
Really?
Unfortunately, it's not on by default. I don't know. I think they removed it at some point. So what you want to do is you want to get something called Key Remap for MacBook. And it's from pqrs.org. And I verified that it works.
Really?
Installed this, rebooted my machine. It actually alerted me to the fact, because we have that little script we talked about, Dave, that it installed a couple of launch daemons. So I think it's installing something at a kernel level, because I guess it has to remap the keyboard. And then basically once I rebooted, now it does a whole bunch of other stuff, all sorts of other key remappings, but without doing anything. Once you reboot and you install this, if you hold down the function key, then you get the virtual numeric keypad, which I think is around the 789 UIO JKL area on the keyboard.
Wow.
So,
interesting. Dude, that's pretty cool.
Updated for Lion. Yeah, so for people that are still doing that and don't want to either get an external keyboard. I guess that's the other answer. I think maybe an Apple external keyboard could do that, or a standalone numeric keypad. But why do that? So the only caveat is you got to hold down the function key, but it sounds like that's not a big deal.
Yeah, right. Oh, very cool, man. Thank you. Thank you for finding that. All right. We're running toward the end of the show. There are two things I wanted to point out. One was one that I stumbled on, and then the other was from a listener. When you're visiting a web page, the web servers have a way of kind of behind the scenes telling your browser how long it should cache certain things. When you pull down a web page, you're almost certainly pulling down more than just the HTML of the web page. You're likely pulling down images and other assets that you can see, but you're also pulling down other assets that maybe you can't see, maybe little JavaScript files, CSS files, things that might help define the layout of the page. And as each of those comes in, the web server tells your browser, hey, even though the web page might change every 10 minutes because it's a news website or something, you know, the CSS, the style sheet and the JavaScript, you don't need to worry about that. Next time you reload the page, you know, go ahead and keep that for an hour or even a month, right? And so sometimes you can load a web page and see things kind of funky. And certainly you can use the Safari empty cache menu to clear all of that out. But if you just want to clear it for that one web page, holding down the Option key and going to the which one is it? Yeah, hold down the Option key and go to the View menu and choose Reload Page. This is one of those instances where you do not see the impact of holding down the Option key in the menu itself. But trust me on this, and I know this because we do this in development with TM all the time. In Safari, holding down the Option key while choosing Reload Page will force it to re-download all of the assets for that page no matter what. So it can be handy if you see a web page acting funky. You might have gotten a stale cache thing going on. So Option Reload is your friend. And it's, you know, that's my tip to you this week. And Luciano has a cool thing, and so we'll call it Cool Stuff Found. Luciano hipped us to the existence of something called the Consultant's Canary, and we'll put, of course, a link in the show notes. But the Consultant's Canary operates on the principle of the first thing that, as a tech support person, so either a professional consultant or, you know, someone helping a family member, which I know many of you wind up doing because you listen to this show and you become your resident expert, and then, you know, suddenly you're the one who everybody calls. And the first thing that we've all kind of learned to ask is, have you installed anything new recently? And of course, users lie. They always say no. And really, it's not that they're lying. It's just that they don't know. And so what Consultant's Canary does is it shows you what aftermarket software, including like plugins and Quick Look stuff and Spotlight stuff, is on a system. And it just lists it. It doesn't disable anything. It doesn't delete anything. It just shows you a list of all of this stuff. And it's really kind of handy because you can just look at it and say, hey, you know, maybe you've seen a plugin cause trouble before, and you could be like, hey, that's right, that's on here. It saves you the time of scouring through the system and finding all of these things. It just shows them to you in one fell swoop in a little terminal window. And then it's up to you to kind of do with that as you please. But it's a really, really handy little tool made by some folks here in San Francisco, I believe. So it's free to download. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes called Consultant's Canary. And I think that anything more that you want to add before I try my luck at bringing the band back in here, John?
No.
No, huh? Okay. Well, let me see what I can do about the band here. We had that weird problem with the other audio comment. So there's the band. Do you hear the band, John?
I hear them. Actually, there's one thing.
Okay.
That I just saw on Twitter. Oh, gosh. Somebody just lost their job. Some guy
That's
wrote
not
in.
Funny.
Well, I think he did, but it was an article. I think it was Wall Street Journal. And the guy said CIOs are going to have a big problem now dealing with all the new Retina display MacBooks because they're going to take up more bandwidth. Think about
that.
Well,
I mean, in part, that's true.
No.
Right?
No.
No? They're not going to take up more bandwidth?
I'm missing
the joke, clearly. Yeah. I mean, for loading web pages?
The article implied that having more pixels on your screen increases the amount of network bandwidth that your computer uses.
I do. Web developers,
you're
can
fired too.
Because this is something we've been talking about at TMO, and we have not updated TMO for Retina display. Most websites aren't updated for Retina display, but it used to be. But prior to Retina display, so you know, I'm going to kill the band here for a second because this is.
I don't think it's going to have as massive an impact as the writer of this article thought. I mean, it's not like it's going to increase network bandwidth 100-fold and that your network's going to crumble because now everybody has a Retina display MacBook. That was what this guy was kind of implying, and I think most people said, I don't think you really understand how computers work. Yes, I understand what you're saying is that so a higher resolution.
But let me explain this to our listeners. Okay, so it used to be that if you had, let's say, a 100 by 100 pixel graphic or a 100 by 100 graphic, and I'm just going to call it that, and I'm going to leave pixels and points out. But if you had a 100 by 100 graphic, that was 100 by 100 points on the screen, which was also 100 by 100 pixels. And that is true right up until you get to these devices that act as Retina displays. And now you have to abstract. Points no longer equal pixels, right? It used on one, well, they do on one-to-one screens, but you cannot assume anymore that points equal pixels. So if you have a 100 by 100 graphic, you have to now think of that as a 100 point by 100 point graphic. And on a normal screen, that's going to be 100 pixels by 100 pixels. But on a Retina screen, that 100 by 100 graphic could have 200 by 200 pixels. And it's up to you as the web developer to actually code the web page so that you put them both out there and you let the browser, the user's browser, decide which one to pull. And it's in, ostensibly anyway, smart enough to know that I'm on a Retina machine, so I should pull the 2X version of that. And that works on the iPad and the iPhone, at least the Retina versions of them. So yes, I mean, there will be more bandwidth. I don't think it's going to crater the internet or anything, and I don't think CIOs are going to have to run screaming to mommy about where they're going to find all this extra bandwidth. But it does mean that websites are now at least have to consider whether or not it's something they want to do and code with these extra images. So yeah, I mean, and the same is true of apps, I would assume. Right. I mean, if you're building apps for, well, they even said it on Monday, right, that they've coded some of their pro apps for Retina display. And that means probably going through and updating all the images inside of their apps, just like you had to with iOS devices. Right. So there you have it.
OK, bring in the bet. Yeah, I sent you a link to the article, but the overwhelming majority of comments were. Not positive.
All right. Let's see. You can reach us if you have a question or a tip or a cool stuff found, or really, if you just feel the need to reach us for any reason whatsoever, you can email us at feedback@macgeekab.com.
And in case you didn't hear Dave, it's feedback@macgeekab.com.
I fear that somehow we have got a huge gap between us here, so I don't know how the show's going to be. We might have been running all over each other for the last 20 minutes of the show, but it is feedback@macgeekab.com. I don't think our latency is as tight as we thought it was, and I think that's due to the audio circuitry on this MacBook Air, but we will see, or you will have already seen. So our apologies if John and I have been running over each other a little bit. That's the reason for it. And we'll know that, but of course it's going to be far too late to fix it for this show, but we will check it out and know it for the next time we're doing the mobile version. So that's our apologies in advance in reverse, if that makes any sense at all. You can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which with delay is John
4335.
That's right. You can find us on Facebook, as we said before, facebook.com/MacGeekab. John, go ahead and tell them about Twitter.
I'm John Efron. He's Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete is Pilot Pete. MacGeekab is MacGeekab. MacObserver is MacObserver. I think that's it.
All right. You can, let's see, we want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this show to AAC for us and for you. Cashfly provides all of the bandwidth to get the podcast from us to you. And the podcast marketplace this month includes BB Edit from Barebones Software, PDF Pen from Smile, Gazelle to sell your Mac, and Pimp My Screen, of course, from Apollon, all through Backbeat Media. And that wraps this up. And so we begin another 7 years of doing the podcast. Pretty amazing, John. I never expected to be doing this 7 years later, 7 years ago, but I'm very happy that we are.
Me neither.
Have fun. We'll be back middle of next week, I think, with MacGeekab 403 Premium. Have fun. Don't get caught.